Hi, everyone. This is Drew. Hey, we've been providing authentic, in-depth interviews about spiritual stuff for over 15 years now. But there's a change a-coming. Now, if you've already heard this message, just skip ahead to the interview. But if it's the first time, will you do me a solid and hang with me for just a few minutes? You know, about 15 years ago when I moved back to Canada after being a pastor in Australia, I realized that there was no way in the world that I should be in any form of spiritual leadership for so many reasons. But I think the main reason was because I've always struggled with belief. Now look, I'm still incredibly curious about what gets people through the night, and more often than not, it ends up being someone's faith or spiritual beliefs. So I created a radio show that set out to interview cultural icons and religious leaders, celebrities, and, you know, everyday people about what they believe, but more importantly, why they believe. And along the way, my faith has gone from simply being a noun to a verb. And I've also discovered that doubt is actually more compatible with faith than certainty. In other words, I no longer feel guilty about my doubts. So thanks for tuning in as I interview all sorts of people about all sorts of faith. I hope their journeys, no matter what they believe, have had a profound impact on your journey, and that your faith has also become a verb. Because, in my opinion, being spiritually neutral, that's an oxymoron. By the way, thanks to Joy Radio for letting me broadcast all of this spiritual tension, because I think this tension is where real faith is cultivated, in between hope and doubt. Together, Joy Radio and my team have created Canada's most listened to spiritual talk show. Okay, that's all the kumbaya stuff. Now here's the ask. And I know, I'm the same. I'm rolling my eyes as well. It's kind of like when Wikipedia puts up that note asking for money every once in a while, or when your local publicly supported radio or TV station does one of those annoying fundraising campaigns. I completely ignore them as well. I guess my thinking is that an organization like Wikipedia probably makes enough money anyway. Or, worst case scenario, they'll find enough people to support them. But please, if you're a regular listener of the Drew Marshall Show, man, I kind of really need your help. The station I've been broadcasting on for over 15 years has never actually paid me to do the show. Instead, they've let me try to sell advertising. But that's been a little more of a challenge than I imagined, because religious advertisers sometimes feel that my show isn't religious enough, and quote-unquote normal advertisers sometimes feel like we're too religious. So it's been a long, crazy uphill battle over the last 15 years just trying to make a living in that tension. Trust me, I'm struggling to pay the bills just like you are. But as we start season 16 in September, we just found out something huge. Joy Radio will now be charging me for airtime. Now, surprisingly, this is standard practice for a lot of radio shows, especially on faith-based radio stations. But the bottom line is that there will now be an astounding 30% hike in costs for me. Ugh. Airtime's not cheap, and to be honest, finding even more advertisers to cover that 30%, it's kind of freaking me out a little bit. So, maybe you've been downloading our podcast and don't actually have to listen to the advertising that our radio audience listens to during each live four-hour show. And by the way, just so you know, any advertising we've actually been able to find has only ever covered about 70% of our annual costs. So the ask is this: would you consider going from being just a consumer of our show to becoming a patron? Would you mind throwing us a few bucks each month just to help us cover that 30% difference? Heck, you know what? If we can get enough patrons supporting the Drew Marshall Show, we could feasibly get to the point where we become completely listener-supported without the need of any advertising. Now that would be amazing. So, a patron. What? What is that? Well, a patron was the kind of person who allowed Shakespeare to create a product that also spoke of similar life tensions. Tensions that most people were living, but few were admitting to each other. A patron is someone who appreciates the product they're consuming so much that they're willing to throw a few bucks towards securing a future for that product. Now, just FYI, there are over 100,000 creators being supported by patrons through Patreon right now. So this is becoming the new way to say thank you to those who create the products we all consume online. Now, I fully understand the fact that I'm certainly no Shakespeare. I get that. But someone said to me recently that they would absolutely support our show monthly. Methinks there might be others. Yea, but maybe not. Let's findeth outeth. Yeah, I should never do that again. So here's the ask. Will you support the Drew Marshall Show $4 or $9 or $19 a month? By the way, that's American coin. So sorry to everyone listening from parts of the world whose currency is kind of struggling against the US dollar. But here's the other thing. If you cannot afford it, Please, obviously, no worries. When I used to be a pastor, I would say, hey, when the offering plate goes around, if you can give, give. If you need some, take some. So just take our show for free, guilt-free, if you can't afford $4 a month. Please. Because the conversations we're having in the Drew Marshall Show, I honestly feel need to be heard no matter what. Look, my dream is to have the most brutally authentic spiritual talk show in the world. And here's why that's important to me. Because I really believe that a key ingredient to spiritual growth is authenticity. And the tension of a brutally authentic spiritual talk show makes some people feel uncomfortable. But as far as I'm concerned, faith is messy and it can be brutal. But instead of looking the other way, our show dares to stare back into this beautiful mess called faith. So thanks for your support as we continue to live in the tension between belief and doubt, and while trying not to take ourselves too seriously along the way. Hopefully you'll laugh, sometimes you'll cringe, but no matter what, please know that what I care about most is brutally authentic spirituality. Now, go drink the Kool-Aid, will ya?
Cult reference!
And become a patron of The Drew Marshall Show. Thanks for listening.
Loosen my load, I got 7 women on my mind.
Thinking about the old songs that we used to sing. And they go, take it easy, right? You just want to take it easy. This is what I'm trying to figure out. So how do I take it easy in life? I know the song's talking about girls and hippie stuff and the Eagles and all that thing. But peaceful, easy feeling, you know, that's another one. Thinking about all these kind of kumbaya songs we used to listen to. Well, you know, I should have played one from the ranch days. Hey, Gord?
Oh, yeah.
What would I have played? Oh, I know. Jesus said, come to the water, stand by my side. That song got played every campfire to the point where we were all seriously annoyed with it.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember that.
All right. It's time to talk about the Enneagram here on the show. For thousands of years, spiritual teachers from many different traditions have reminded us of the richness of the human spirit and its potentials. But without real self-knowledge, it's not possible to awaken the deeper truths of the soul or to sustain whatever degree of realization we have attained. One of the most powerful tools for understanding ourselves and others is the Enneagram, and that's been true for me personally. It's an ancient symbol of unity and diversity, change and transformation. So I'm inviting all of you to join us for this four-part series. Last week, so this is throughout the month of July, every Saturday in the month of July, last week we did sort of an overview of the Enneagram. And if you missed that and you want to catch up, you go to our website, drewmarshall.ca, click on last week's show, and you'll see there that we chatted with Gail Scott, who's a master Enneagram teacher and consultant, founder and director of the Enneagram Mystery School in Boulder, Colorado. And she's joining us again today. Because now we're going to talk about, we're going to dive into each of the personality types. We're going to tackle 3 a week. Let's see, there's 3 weeks left. 3 a week, that equals 9. And that's what Ennea stands for. That's Latin for 9. Gord, did you know that?
I didn't know that.
I like being smarter than you sometimes. It's so rare. So Gord joins us. Tim is away today, which is good because, well, sorry, it's not good what happened to him. He wiped out on his motorcycle and wrecked his arm a little bit. So he's not feeling well, and I wouldn't be either. I saw the pictures. Very, very gross. So Gord joins us in the studio, and Gord does not know what personality type he is, so he's going to be listening intently to see if he is one of the 3 that we're chatting about today. Now, the interns, I made them do it. I said, you got to do it. And they went to the Enneagram Institute and did the $12 American test. I paid for it because that's the kind of guy I am. And one of them, their personality types will be spoken about today. So before we get on with all of that, let's join Gail on the line. Hello, Gail. How are you today?
Hi, I'm doing well, Drew. How about yourself?
Your phone sounds fantastic. Why does it? What, I don't understand what the problem was.
Well, it just was a matter of calling back enough times so we got it right.
Okay. All right. Well, you sound lovely, darling. Thank you again for joining us. Well, this week on the show, we're talking about type 8, the challenger, type 9, the peacemaker, and type 1, the reformer. Mm-hmm. And these 3 fall into a certain category. Tell us about the category first.
Well, the 3 categories of the Enneagram system and symbol, of which has 9 types, it's 3 groupings of 3, and they're divided into groups of the 3 centers of intelligence. So there are actually 3 main components to human intelligence, right? And the 9 types fall into 3 groups of 3. And each grouping is associated with one of these centers or functions of human intelligence. And by intelligence, I mean both a way of functioning in the world, like our smarts, you know, and also a way of receiving and processing information. So briefly, the three centers of intelligence, the first one that we'll be speaking about today, is the instinctive center. It's about the intelligence of the body, or we call it the belly center or the gut center. It's about being in the body. And it's actually true that information comes through the body, or what we call the gut brain, the enteric nervous system, before it goes to the heart or the mind. So people who are in this center have gut, very strong gut feelings about things. And then that's the type 8, 9, and 1. Type 2, 3, and 4 are in the emotional feeling center. That's the intelligence of the heart. It's about experiencing feelings and emotions and being affected.
That's me. I'm going to bring me in as many times as possible today.
Feelings, emotions, being affected. That's true. Okay. And then the 5, 6, and 7 are in the intellectual or thinking center.
That's not me.
Because this is about the intelligence of the head.
Yep.
And, well, our capacity for, like, mental awareness. And, of course, we have all three, of course. You know, they operate simultaneously. But one of these is our home base. We each deal with all the issues of the three centers and all nine types, but one particular center of intelligence and, of course, one type is going to be your dominant type. That will be your home base, and that also it gives you your major gifts, also creates major issues. So today we're going to be talking about the three types in the instinctive center, types 8s, 9s, and 1s. And these personality types, ego types, are concentrated around issues related to the body, either embodiment or loss of contact with the body. And the particular issues are, it's about aliveness and strength and vitality and groundedness and connectedness and wholeness and fullness and immediacy and will and energy, flow, alignment, also issues of independence and autonomy, lots of control. So there's a certain feeling when you hear those words, right? And so the type 8, 9, and 1, they're all in this court, and they all are part of this instinctive center intelligence, which means that they do perceive information from the world through their gut. They're gut-type people.
Right, right. Okay, before we get into type 8, are we starting with 8 or 1?
Eight.
Okay, we'll start with 8. But before we do that, we're going to go through 8, 9, and 1, only 3 today, and then next week will be 2, 3, and 4. I just know that there are people who grew up with the kind of conditioning that I grew up with that are going to hear things like the Enneagram and personality and, they look at the symbol and they, I'm not sure if this is, you know, if God would want me to do this. Is there any, give me at least one reason that would help people just chill if they're thinking, Drew's going off his rocker again, he's into some weird whatever, you know, like I'm going to Pagan Fest in a couple of weeks and I can hear people going, this is part of that old pagan stuff or whatever.
Well, interestingly enough, the Enneagram actually draws from all of the major world religions and wisdom traditions. I can give you one specific thing is that back when the original desert fathers, whom I like to call the desert elders, the first Christian monastics, actually were the ones that came up with what was originally referred to and called the nine deadly sins, the nine mortal sins. Now, those nine mortal sins were the way that we would, the word for sin, Greek word for sin is hamartia, that meant the way we would miss the mark in trying to establish our connection with God, our own divinity. There's a way that something would knock us off, would make us miss, you know, the arrow going into the target. And those nine ways, those nine mistakes, were how we sin. Now, later on, that was, for various reasons, turned into seven, so now we have the seven basic sins, the seven mortal sins, but originally it was nine. And those nine are what we now call the passions of the nine types. So there's a very strong and direct early Christian monastic relationship to the creation. It's not actually, the Enneagram wasn't created, it was really discovered. So there are a lot of just a lot of connections to Christianity, to Judaism, to all the faiths, really.
Okay, I like to say this about the Enneagram to help some of the Christians chill. You're right. There was a lot of folks in that what we used to be called the New Age movement that kind of latched onto the Enneagram. But really, just because some group of people latch onto it and they don't have the same belief system as you, that means that what they grabbed onto is wacky? No, you're wacky if you think that. The second thing is, one of the most revered Franciscan monks, Father Richard Rohr, I just heard being interviewed on Oprah's Super Soul Sunday thing or whatever it's called. Mm-hmm. And he is, I mean, this guy loves Jesus. And he is so into this that he has written a book, an excellent book about the Enneagram. So if you don't want to trust somebody who isn't a Christian, then trust Richard Rohr and read his book. In the meantime, have a listen and see if any of this stuff helps you. And I'm telling you right now, this has helped me be less of a jerk, period.
Which is a good thing.
It is a great thing. And it's helped me to practice compassionate, non-judgmental self-awareness. I'm self-aware. I'm so self-aware that it's painful. I know how much of a jerk I am. But then the next step is to practice compassionate, non-judgmentalism when it comes to that self-awareness. And that has helped me lighten up when it comes to myself, when it comes to me, leaning into God. You know, sometimes when we think we're such rat bags, we go, oh, God doesn't want to have anything to do with me. Well, when you understand yourself a little bit better, you can surrender better to the Creator. And then finally, it has helped me see other people and cut them some slack because I see them a little better holistically because I understand their type a little bit better. And I don't take things as personally anymore. How's that?
That's right, and something I always like to stress when people discover the Enneagram, one of the promises that always comes true when you get into this a little bit deeply is that we all start from a place of believing that we are just dead center in our perspective and how we see things and how right we are about everything and how slightly crazy or off the mark everybody else is. When you understand and do some studying of all nine types, you realize, no, we only have the perspective of one-ninth of the pie. We're just one slice.
Yeah.
And my perspective is not any more valid or true, objectively true, than anyone else's perspective. We actually have nine different ways of seeing and experiencing the world and relating to each other. So that creates an enormous amount of both, I would say, humility and also tolerance and understanding for our brothers and sisters. And I don't think there's anything more Christian than that.
Well done. Well said. We don't need to talk anymore. Bye, Gail. Okay, type 8, the challenger, the powerful, dominating type, self-confident, decisive, willful, and confrontational.
Yes, indeed, the challenger. When we talk about type 8, the challenger, they're a very, assertive, aggressive type, and they make a lot of impact on people. But I'd like to start by just mentioning the essence or the spiritual core of the type. We want to honor that beautiful, real quality of being that this person, this type, is living for and wants to embody. So the essence or the spiritual core of type 8, we call the challenger, is the strength, the vividness, the power of now. As an 8, I live for things to be real and immediate. So real strength, real aliveness is the sacred territory for the 8, and it's what the 8 yearns for. So each type, all of us, lose contact, with being, with divinity, as a result of identifying with the ego. And once that illusion of separation from being happens, then we try to make it up with our ego. So in essence, we're actually orienting toward that quality of realness and aliveness. But in ego, we have to sort of create a fake version of it, an ersatz version of it. So that's why 8s tend to be, aggressive and wanting to be in charge and in control about things. But with the healthy 8 in particular, it's like they have this real aliveness that comes with a kind of vulnerability. And the beauty of the 8 is about their here-ness, their here and now-ness. When an 8 walks in the room, you tend to notice, right? Their energy is so expansive, it literally precedes them. There's a commanding presence that people respond to in 8s. 8s are in touch with their instinctual animal energies. They're in that triad. that those animal energies that are running through us, and it makes them become kind of like this strong, brawny animal presence, you know, like a mama bear, and it can really magnetize us. There's a way that the eighth energy meets the environment that's really often very compelling and charismatic. So in the eighth, we see what courage, willpower, self-reliance, leadership, authority, as well as the dark side of power, which is the ability to destroy what, you know, what power has created. But I will say about the eights, when they're healthy, no other type, no other Enneagram personality type has as great a capacity for exerting a constructive influence in the lives of many, of even of the world. But when they're unhealthy, it's also true that no other type can really so completely misuse power or become so totally destructive.
Okay, now I just want to bring into this conversation a couple things. First of all, we are streaming live on Facebook. If you want to, I don't know, watch us in studio or wave at Tucker the Wonder Dog or make fun of Gord who's sitting across from me, feel free to log into our Facebook page, the Drew Marshall Show Facebook page. And I don't know, it just feels weird having people watching us. This is why I did radio is, you know, you can pick your nose and nobody cares, but now they care. Now, the other thing I want to bring into this conversation is about the challenger and misidentifying your type or misidentifying someone else's. So many people along the way have said, oh, Drew, that's Drew. Powerful, dominating, self-confident, decisive, willful, confrontational. Gord, you know me enough. Would you have possibly put me into that category, the challenger, knowing what you know about me?
Possibly, but probably not.
Because you know me better than that.
Because I know you better than that.
Right. So the initial...
Initially, when I walk into a room,
yeah. I wonder how much of that has to do with stature. I'm 6'4", 240.
Right, and the voice.
Right, the voice, communicator, confident, I don't know, whatever. Yeah. So people have lumped me into that category before, and I feel very picked on.
Poor guy.
Yeah, no type, you know, is better than any other type. What's important is what level of health or what level of development we've achieved within our own type. But there, as I said, we all have a little bit of each type in us, but no question that we have one dominant type. Womb to tomb, we don't change types, but anybody can look like anything in certain situations. But eights know that they're eights. A lot of people are eight wannabes and, you know, would like to think that they're eights because the eights are the true and natural, you know, leaders of the pack. Some other names for the eight are the leader, the protector, the provider, the entrepreneur, the maverick. But not all eights are leaders and bosses, but it's very true that they have this decisive, dominating energy. Like if I'm a type eight plant foreman or store manager or school principal or whatever, like I'm the person you have to deal with. It's very clear to everyone that I'm in charge. I mean, I can be a type 8 soccer mom, but everybody knows, you know, who's the head of the house, you know, who's in charge. Now, we do call the 8 the challenger because they like to take on challenges, and they also like to give challenges because it tests their will and power in the world, and they love that feeling. It helps them to feel alive. I'm interested as an 8 in seeing how I'll do when I go up against, you know, the environment. If I can assert myself, if I can overcome resistance or opposition, if I can force my will or, you know, manifest my vision in the world, it reinforces my sense of self and my sense of aliveness. So eights look for challenges to feel more alive. That's not necessarily true as a leading, you know, indicator of personality about any of the other types, including four, your type.
Okay. The other thing that you were, when you were speaking there, that you got me thinking about one of our interns. So I had both of the interns do the Enneagram test. They went to Enneagram Institute website, spent $12 American. I paid for it.
You mentioned that already.
Yeah. Did I mention I paid for it? I just want to mention that I paid for it. And they... So they sent me their results, and one of them sent me the results, and I went, yep, that's you, that's totally you, nailed it. And the other one sent me the results, and I went, hold on a second, is that really you? And we'll talk about their stuff in a little bit, but my question here is, when people are doing this test, they do either or questions. So question number one, are you like this or are you more like this? You don't get A, B, C, D, and E. You get this one or that one.
Right.
And so that's really hard for some people. You just got to answer as best you can.
Right.
You know, and then the other thing is, this is what I've been told, and correct me if I'm wrong, I love being wrong, is that when you're doing the thing, you've got to answer as honestly as to who you are, not who you want to be, not who you'd like to be, not who, you know, one of these days, or who you aspire. Like, for example,
that's right.
I wish I was way more of a peacemaker or a helper or, you know, all the nice kumbaya types. I wish I was way more kumbaya. And if I had that rolling through my brain when I'm doing the test, it would skew my answers, would it not?
Well, yes. Let me say this about the test. There is no perfect test. That particular test tends to score about between 80 and 85% correct. But any test, any Enneagram test that you take, it's important to, I mean, don't take it as gospel, but to look at the three highest scoring types and study those and read a little bit about them. And one of them is bound to pop out at you as being much more true than the others. It's very difficult to design a test like this because it's getting people to speak candidly and truthfully about exactly what you said, not how I would like to be, how I wish I were, but how I actually do show up in life. So it's very difficult. So take it with a grain of salt, look at your top three scores, and then read about those three types.
Right, right. Okay. Anything else you want to say about the Challenger before we move on to type nine, which one of our interns is?
Oh, so much to say about the Challenger. This is definitely the most openly assertive and aggressive personality. It's like they just meet life head on with a lot of strength and confidence. They're intense and direct. In fact, indirectness like drives them crazy. They tend to be really independent and resourceful, like determined people. They're very action-oriented. They're often very straight-talking. They're also very competitive and shrewd. And importantly, these are the power brokers. They're comfortable with power. Power is the name of the game for an eight. So they tend to be the natural leaders. And they just look and sound like they know what's going on, right? So other people, non-eights, tend to follow them. And so eights tend to rise in the top, to the top in terms of, you know, authority. And they not only want to take the leadership position, but they have the attributes that make them natural leaders. They have this amazing energy, for one thing. Hmm. They're, as I mentioned, they're in touch with their animal instincts and drives. They have a lot of self-confidence. They're competitive. And they have the will and the desire to be in charge at all times. They want to be the captain of their own ship. And that's not true of all types. Other types are very happy to let someone, you know, take the pot shots and be in charge. There's I just want to say there's a new movie out right now in North America called Skyscraper, which starring Dwayne Johnson, better known as The Rock.
Yep.
And also star of the Fast and Furious, the film franchise. He, his father is a Nova Scotian descent who was known as, he was a professional wrestler known as Rocky Johnson. And I believe that Dwayne Johnson played in the Canadian League for a while, but then he became a wrestler. And so he clearly exudes type 8 characteristics, and he always plays 8s. He's always saving the day. He puts himself in danger. He's going to protect his family. He's going to be the hero. He's the supercharged, you know, in the guy who's everybody is following, and sometimes he has to do it by himself, but he's going to save the day. Just, you know, guts and glory. It was a very good illustration of the type 8 energy.
So what I hear you saying is that type 8s need to be well built.
They don't need to be, but when they are, it certainly helps to sort of fill out the energy.
Yeah. Are there any numbers on type 8s? How many are women? How many are men? Kind of statistics, numbers, anything?
You know, it's pretty easy. It's pretty even. I mean, we only have a limited, you know, how many people know the Enneagram and submit, you know, subject themselves to these kinds of, you know, so we don't know about the entire world. It does seem to be fairly evenly apportioned. Type 8 women often have a difficult time in life because the 8 energy is what we would call sort of classically male, volcanic, you know, assertive, aggressive, phallic energy. But there are as many female 8s as 8s. And they take their place in the world. They often rise to positions of power where that's allowed. Mm. I feel very, very just terribly sorry for type 8 women in countries where that is not allowed, where they're not allowed to be competitive or to rise to the top or to be in charge of anything. I think it must, well, it is terribly, little beyond frustrating or maybe sure. dangerous to have that energy as a woman. But I would say there's the same number. A lot of, who am I thinking of, Indira Gandhi, you know, world leaders who've been women.
Yeah. All right. Again, just letting you know, we're chatting about the Enneagram. And as far as I'm concerned, this is the number one personal transformation tool that has helped me more than anything else out there. And that's why we're spending a chunk of time in July, each week in July, featuring Gail Scott, who's a master Enneagram teacher and consultant. So the other thing is we are on Facebook Live. If you want to wave to us on there, no, not wave to us. That's ridiculous. We do the waving. I don't know how you're going to wave at us. We can't see you. But if you want to send us questions about the Enneagram, I'm looking at the screen right now, and anything that you send will pop up on my screen. Gord is having a wave. The interns are waving. Everyone's just silly now with waving. So that's the Drew Marshall Show Facebook page. That we've just been chatting about the Challenger.
The Rock is actually a social role for the eight. They do they expect people expect them to show up as the Rock, like the person who's going to take charge and, you know, be the protector.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Okay. Let's move on with your permission to Type 9, the Peacemaker, and Alex is here. Mike and Alex and Erica to switch seats, because we're going to bring Alex in on this conversation. She did they went to the Enneagram Institute, did the test, and that was her number one, the Peacemaker. The easygoing, self-effacing type, receptive, reassuring, agreeable, complacent. Now, I don't know how to start this one. Should we just, you know what, Gail, let's let you go into a little bit more description about the Peacemaker, and then Alex has a few questions he wants to ask you. So, ready, Gail, go!
Okay, so this is Type 9, the Peacemaker, the easygoing, self-effacing type. Some other names are the healer, the optimist, the comforter, the utopian, and also nobody special. So, Type 9s, in stark contrast to Type 8 that we were just speaking about, 9s do not come across as big personalities like 8s do. In fact, they can seem nondescript or indistinct. They very much prefer to give other people the limelight, to let other people lead the charge, and they see themselves as somehow less important or consequential. They like to sort of fade into the background, not always be noticed. It's easy for them to get swept up in other people's agendas and projects and, you know, forget about themselves. But what's most important to the 9, to the Peacemaker, is that they want to maintain their all-important inner peace. So, unlike the 8, they don't like confrontations. They are very uncomfortable, in fact, asserting themselves. They're not comfortable expressing negative feelings or opinions. They like to focus on the positive. What they don't like to do is make other people uncomfortable or challenge other people or create arguments or create, you know, negative feelings. They want to focus on the positive at all times to keep everyone feeling good and feeling peaceful. They very much value their connections with family and friends, and they like what is familiar and comfortable. And the 9 actually represents the core spiritual issue of losing contact with or falling asleep to our essential natures. So the 9 has trouble with issues of embodiment. They have difficulty owning their own fire and juice, like being in their life force. It's difficult for them to wake up and just go for it. They're not often they're not self-aware enough to become aware of themselves. Unless they, you know, do the inner work. But their basic desire is to have wholeness, inner stability, and peace of mind. And down the levels, they'll do that at all costs. So they're in search of harmony, oneness, you know, peace, wholeness, and community and communion. But they're very self-effacing. You know, it's easy for them to put themselves on the back burner. I erase myself. I don't want to stand out. I'll defer to other people who I think are more important or who are considered more important. I can basically become invisible and just kind of blend into the wall pack. I can do a disappearing act in my own life. Although, when I want to say this always go, these patterns become enhanced in childhood. And for the type 9, we say they have, in psychology, what's called a middle child syndrome, or the invisible child syndrome, or the ignored child syndrome. But it's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. The type 9 babies usually come into the world, you know, very peaceful. They're not kicking and screaming. They're not demanding attention. They're mostly trying to keep everybody getting along well with each other. And so they sort of disappear, and people expect them to not make waves, to not have demands. And okay. They get into that pattern.
Okay. Alex. Hi. What I need to know from you is any of this resonating with you?
Yes. All of it. I feel like what she just described me. And like what she said about when the baby is born, you can kind of tell that the baby is a type 9 by the way they act. I came out, I was born and I didn't cry, and all the nurses loved me because I was so cute and I didn't cry, and they took me away from my mom and she couldn't even see me. So
really?
Yeah.
Interesting stuff.
Uh-huh.
What is the hold on, I don't even know where to start here. Let's start with this. You've just been introduced to the Enneagram. You've done a little reading. They sent you the results of your test. You scored a 9, peacemaker. Mm-hmm. Now that you've read a little bit about it, what is the bummer about being a peacemaker? What's the downside of Alex being a peacemaker? Not saying that all peacemakers are like this, but for you being a peacemaker, what's the bummer part of it?
I'd like to be a bit more upfront with things. Okay. And like when there's conflict or I'm upset about something, usually I'll keep quiet about it.
Okay.
And I won't bring it up.
Right.
And I thought that would be like the best thing to do, keep it to myself and try to let everything go.
And keep the peace.
Yeah, but then I would realize that that's not healthy, and it's good to communicate and talk about your feelings. So I've kind of learned how to do that.
Okay.
But I still sometimes keep quiet and keep to myself.
Right. Is there anything that you actually want to tell me and tell me off about and confront me about?
No. I don't think
so. Oh, come on. Now's your chance. He invited it.
No, we don't want to put 9s on the spot.
Oh, no.
It never works.
Never does work.
Anxiety producing.
Yes.
So that's very interesting, and I want to say that these behavior patterns that become calcified, that become actually our trance of personality, begin in very early childhood as actually brilliant strategies for surviving and defending ourselves. Like we all of us, have things that we have to deal with as infants and young children and children, you know, with our family of origin, all kinds of things, and every type looks into their little toolbox and realizes, well, this is what I got. This is how I'm going to survive this. This is how I can get through. For the type 9, the way to survive and thrive amidst whatever craziness they're born into is by dissociating from what's going on. And 9s have a superpower of being able to dissociate and not let what's going on around them bother them. They go into this sort of inner sanctum place where things are much happier and brighter and lighter, and they survive that way. And then as we get older, that just becomes, you know, our default mechanism for how we're going to defend ourselves.
Okay. Sorry, go ahead.
I also want to mention one of the great gifts of the 9 and why we refer to the 9 as the peacemaker is that they have this amazing ability to see all points of view. And that's why they do, in fact, become wonderful negotiators and mediators and marriage and family counselors and spiritual counselors, because they're not stuck on their own point of view, and they have the ability to truly understand how other people feel about things and to honor those feelings and to bring people to the peace talks, to the table, because they can identify with everyone's point of view. So they have this wonderful peacemaking ability, and they use that certainly with their family and friends. When you're in the presence of a healthy 9, it's like you have this, you relax. It's like, oh, this feels good. I can just relax.
I have never felt relaxed around Alex once. She intimidates me, makes me very, no, I'm just kidding. Well, actually, let me bring in this. Alex, I'm going to throw you under the bus because you basically, I've done it other times and you haven't left, so I'm going to do it again. How are you with anxiety and anxiousness and that kind of stuff?
I'm better now that I'm on medication.
Okay, so that is...
But I've always dealt with very bad anxiety. I've had terrible anxiety. I would avoid a lot of things just because of how I felt inside. I have a little bit of depression sometimes.
Okay.
But now, like, the past couple of years have been great. I've gotten help, and I've looked inside myself and realized who I am, and I've dealt with those things.
Good. Can I just say, I've got to talk to her for a second. First of all, so proud of you for so many reasons. And I'm actually excited. You know, I don't actually get excited. I sound excited, but I don't actually get excited. I'm too sarcastic to be excited about anything. I am actually very excited for you to look into more of your personality type, so it can give you the perspective that you need, I think. Because in my case, for example, I looked at my type and went, and so that has helped me now, instead of go, oh, Drew, you're such a jerk, I now go, oh, Drew, you're such a four. That little difference has helped me lighten up on myself so much more, and it helped me breathe through life a lot more. And that's what I want for you.
You realize that nothing's wrong with you. It's normal.
Yeah. There's a whole bunch of whack jobs like you out there. Yeah. Okay. And the other thing is, forgive me, but you remember the first day?
Oh, yeah.
So do you want to share with our listeners what happened with you for the first day?
I think it was when you called me and you said, would it be okay to start this day? And all of a sudden, my anxiety kicked in. And I just sank, and I thought, maybe I can't do this. Maybe I can't. And Drew talked to me for a second about the job, and I just, like, I shot up, and I was like, I can do this. Of course I can do this. This sounds awesome. If I don't do this, I'm going to regret it tonight, and I'm going to hate myself for it. So I'm like, yeah, let's do it. I want to, and I'm so glad I did it.
But the anxiety crept in, didn't
yes.
it? Yeah. Gail, sorry. I just had to have a little chat with Alex there.
Another important question, too, for nines to ask themselves, Alex, is, because even more significant than anxiety, is the issue of anger. Like, how do you hold anger in your body? Nines, because they want everyone to feel peaceful, are loath to express anger. And again, this starts very early in the family of origin situation. And they bottle up their anger, and they cork it, and they stuff it down themselves, and they're afraid of expressing it. And so for any real transformational inner growth process for the nine, one thing that, probably the most important thing to put your attention on is how do I deny my anger? How do I not express my anger? And what has that cost me? And what am I angry about? Starting, because there's a whole litany of things, you know, once you admit it, that goes all the way back to perhaps, you know, being angry about, you know, not having been paid attention to as a child.
Or not being seen.
Not being seen, being ignored, my voice didn't count, I didn't have a vote. And that carries on through adulthood and our relationships. And nines who are in relationships tend to continue to believe that my voice doesn't matter, I don't have a voice or a vote. And this actually carries over into the manner of speaking. They tend to be very soft-spoken. It's as though they don't feel that anyone is actually listening to them. I've had clients as a therapist who I noticed would be repeating the same thing over and over and over, and it's because they didn't think I was listening. They just assume that people don't care about them or care about their opinions or what they have to say. So it's very important when, as a nine, to sort of train yourself, you know, to develop those muscles so that you can actually voice your preferences and your opinions and have that kind of faith and trust in yourself that what you feel, what you care about matters, and that it should matter to the people, you know, in our lives, to our important others.
So well said. So well. Now, are you getting this?
Yes.
Okay. Questions?
Well, under type compatibility.
Oh, see, now the young girls go right into who should I date? Is that what you're talking about?
No.
Okay, sorry. I just thought I'd jump all over that like a male chauvinist.
I like animals, so it said the passion is a sloth. So is this like a spirit animal?
Yeah, no, it doesn't. It's not. No, it doesn't mean the animal sloth. Originally, it was called acedia, and it refers to not not realizing that we're asleep and not doing what it takes to wake up. It's about self-neglect. It's about inattention to oneself. It's the issue for the nine is, I mean, and they can be very busy. We've got a lot of type nine presidents from, you know, Lincoln to Obama. But the issue is that for the average nine, the issue is that I don't arise in the midst of my doing. There's a certain vacancy, like my own presence is missing. Because nines tend to muffle or dampen down their inner life because they feel it's not important. So there can be this deadening of emotions and desires and wishes and thoughts, right? So that sloth means just not, owning my own fire, my own, you know, vitality, my own life force, and believing in that and putting it out there.
So maybe another way to explain that for you is, no, it's got nothing to do with the animal. You don't look like a sloth. the sloth thing is some people say, well, they're so laid back that they're like a sloth or so chilled or whatever. But it's not right. That you're chilled as a human being. It's that you're chilled about doing the inner work and diving deep in and looking at stuff or expressing yourself. You know, you're kind of lazy about expressing yourself.
Well, I thought, crap, they know how much I sleep.
Yeah, your parents are going, you got it right. She is a sloth. Yeah.
Well, you know, nines tend to be very habitual animals. You know, they have routines. They get into a groove and they don't want anything to change. So, you know, they're famous for, you know, puttering around and, you know, doing their routines. Because if you have routines down, you know, you don't really have to show up. This happens in couples, too, where they become, I have lots of activity, lots of busy work. I'm puttering around, things to keep me busy, but I become the disengaged participant, you know. And I'm like hitting the snooze button all the time. Yeah. And then down in the unhealthy levels, they really do check out. They numb out. They go on automatic pilot and, you know, putting things off till tomorrow and just want to avoid dealing with, you know, anything that might disturb their peace, you know, a little longer. And, you know, maybe the day will be over and I won't have to deal with it at all.
Gail, is it not true that a lot of nines, peacemakers, actually not require, but they actually are sort of nappers and sleepers because they're taking on the energy of everyone around them and everyone else's agenda and stuff that it's exhausting and they actually nap or crash or sleep, you know, that kind of thing.
It's partly due to the fact that they take on everyone else, but it's actually more due to the fact that most of my, remember they're in the instinctual triad, the belly, most of my instinctual energy, that animal energy, goes into holding down my own instinctual fire and energy. Huh. Because if that were to come out, I mean, gosh, who knows what might happen. I'd be, you know, running naked in the streets or,
whoa,
you know, who knows.
Whoa.
But that
we don't do that on AM 1250.
All of that instinctual life force and energy is being constantly defended against, both inner and outer. I'm trying to hold back anything in my universe, in my environment, in my relationships that's going to upset me and challenge my peace. But I'm also tamping down, corking down, holding down all of my own, natural organic instincts to be lively, to be engaged, to be, who I am. So there's so much resistance. There's outer resistance and inner resistance, and that's what creates the fatigue. And so, yes, they often do sleep a lot.
Okay, another question.
Mm-hmm. We kind of touched a bit on this, but what do you think type 9s will do as a job? Most type nines, are they more artistic? Because I'm definitely more artistic. I like jobs where maybe I've always wanted to be a painter, but and I would think that would be a type nine. They keep to themselves and they want to express themselves on
a canvas.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
And I wouldn't think that there would be many type nines doing such things as office work and that type, but I'm not too sure.
Well, of course, we find nines everywhere. Speaking of painters, one of my favorite painters, Monet, who painted those beautiful, you know, tranquil settings of, you know, lilies, and you look at them and you feel like you've just been sucked into this tranquil, you know, peaceful land. So any type can be artists, but the fact is they'll express their art, they'll channel different things and express it in different ways. One thing I've noticed about nines is that they love to work and be in nature. I think every park ranger I've ever met is a nine, for instance, and I've met a lot. They like to be out in the forest, in the parks, at aquariums and zoos.
Yep.
Nines have a very particular connection with nature. Of course, we all do, but nines in particular just identify with that peacefulness of nature, and they love being in those environments. Safari guides, you know, like
African lion safari. You could work there.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, they have. A friend of mine who's a safari guide. I mean, what could be better than driving around out in all this unspoiled nature? You know, sharing the love of nature, you know, with people. They're also very often body workers. Nines have smart bodies. You know, they make wonderful massage therapists and just body workers of all kinds because they have that smart body. I also see a lot of times they're athletes. I would say they're in my experience, they're particularly represented as ice skaters and also baseball players. I think the whole game of baseball is sort of very nine-ish. You know, you're just kind of standing out there enjoying the basketball.
Because it's so boring.
Occasionally you have to catch the ball or something, you know. But,
daydreaming. Okay, all right. Any other questions?
They can also be very gifted musicians or athletes, you know, ballet dancers, skaters, body intelligence.
I've always loved dancing, too. I danced for a long time when I was younger. So.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I have not seen it yet, but I can't wait to see it. There's a documentary out right now called Won't You Be My Neighbor, which is about
Mr. Rogers.
Fred McFeely Rogers, who's the iconic educational preschool TV series, you know, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, that ran for like 30 years or something.
Mm-hmm.
And he was actually a Presbyterian minister, right? And when he graduated from seminary, his specific charge was to minister to children and their families through television. And he thought he was going to produce a TV program for the Presbyterian Church, but actually Rainsbury, who was the head of the children's programming for the CBC in Canada, invited him to Toronto to do a children's program, which was like puppets and music and stuff, and that's how he got the start. But his persona, not his persona, who he actually was, like, he's one of my favorite, you know, very, very healthy type 9 peacemakers. He's kind, he's neighborly, he's tolerant, he just made that connection.
You didn't find him a little creepy?
Not at all. I loved him. And if you found him creepy, let's just keep it to yourself.
Okay. All right. Sorry. Pardon me. Excuse me. We got to move on. So is there anything else from you, Alex?
That was it. That was great.
You sure?
Yes. Thank
Good.
You.
Good. Let's keep talking about this, okay? I'm passionate about this, and I want to see you stand up.
Flourish.
Yeah. Yeah. Way to say that right. Flourish.
Flourish.
Flourish. All right. On the line with Gail Scott, Master Enneagram teacher and consultant, founder and director of the Enneagram Mystery School in Boulder, Colorado. And if you're just tuning in, look, I'm sure if you've been around long enough or if you've done any self-exploration or tried to grow a little bit or try to be less of a jerk, I don't know who does that, that you've looked into different sort of typing systems, like Myers-Briggs is probably the most popular one from a name point of view or brand point of view. But I found the Myers-Briggs thing very stale, very linear, maybe. I don't know. It just didn't impact me at all. And I couldn't remember all the freaking letters and numbers and things. I didn't know what the heck I was doing. And it seemed like it was something for business people and corporate and leadership and all that sort of thing. And again, it's not me. But when I found the Enneagram, I think the main reason I like the Enneagram is because it showed me my own skid marks.
I like that.
It just pointed out, hey, dude, hold on. Yeah, you've got some serious gifts. These are amazing. But look at the backside. Look at the shadow side of who you are. And that's what I love. Of course, as a four, that's what we're all about, looking at the shadow side of things.
That's right.
I'm an Enneagram 4. All right, we talked about the type 8, the challenger, the powerful, dominating type, self-confident, decisive, willful, and confrontational. We talked about type 9, the peacemaker, the easygoing, self-effacing type, receptive, reassuring, agreeable, and complacent. Alex, the intern, did the test on EnneagramInstitute.com, and she scored, the highest score was Peacemaker for her, and she was, well, on commercial break, I said, how was that? She said, it was just bizarre how accurate all that description stuff was, and then even the nature thing that you talked about at the end, right, Gail? I mean, that hit you, mm-hmm. Alex? You're like, oh, yeah, that's, yeah. I love doing that.
Yeah, I thought that was crazy.
So now we're on, sorry, go ahead, Gail.
Speaking of the Myers-Briggs, it talks about a few personality characteristics, extroversion, introversion, things like that. The Enneagram is of just a whole level of analysis different. I mean, it's so much more deep and profound, and it's not something that was created, through contemporary, philosophy or psychology. It's actually an ancient tradition, an ancient symbol, no one actually made it up. We've just been uncovering it as we go along, especially since 1970. But it's been around basically forever because it's actually, the way I see it, it's actually a template for the cosmos, for universe, and what we're talking about is the template for human psychology. And I'll just say that, I've taught this all around the world and to many different cultures, many different languages, different kinds of people, and the nine types hold up universally.
There you go. All right, let's move on to the last type today. Next week, we'll be chatting about the helper, the achiever, and the individualist, type 2, 3, and 4. And those are the heart types, the heart center. Is that, am I using the right words here?
Mm-hmm, the heart center, the feeling center.
Yeah,
the
heart. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I'm one of those because I have feelings.
And you have heart.
And I sometimes. Type 1, the reformer. That's the last one we're chatting about today. The rational, idealistic type, principled, purposeful, self-controlled, and perfectionistic. And Gail, you're probably the best one to chat about this type because you are one.
I am one. I am one. My car license plate says Enya 1.
People think they're driving behind Enya,
Yeah,
oh,
maybe,
let's get her autograph.
But my friends always know where I'm hanging out.
So tell us about you. I mean, this type.
So, the rational, idealistic type, yeah, principled, purposeful. The real quality, the essential quality for the type one is has to do with the sacredness of life, integrity, alignment, and balance. That's the sacred ground of the one. The sacredness, the idea is that when we are awake, every moment is sacred. And in our soul, and particularly in the soul of the one, we remember in some pre-verbal way what this is about. When we are really present, no matter what type we are, the moment we are in, if we're really awake and alive and present, we feel that moment is sacred. We feel a sense of reverence, of sacredness. We're aware of the goodness in the fabric of life, and we know ourselves to be an intrinsic part of that. So type one is about the remembrance of divine perfection. When we are in that transparent state, as all the great mystics have told us, everything in the cosmos is unfolding exactly as it needs to. So it's the recognition of the existence of spiritual dimensions in all that exists, that everything that occurs is in its own way perfect. Everything's part of the beautiful, grand unity. However, when we are become separated from that, it's as though the light has gone out. There is no perfection. There is no goodness. There is no sacredness. And I feel that most acutely as a young one in myself. I feel like I'm very susceptible to that idea of St. Paul's, who I believe is type one, of original sin, that there's something wrong with me. So ones identify with that very strongly and feel throughout their lives that they're in danger of succumbing to some kind of evil or badness or becoming irredeemable. So they fight very, very hard to be good. And they tend to be, in early life, good boys and girls, good Girl Scouts and Boy Scouts. They're always trying to do the right thing. They tend to be compulsively honest. And we call the one the reformer because they're the ones out there trying to reform the world, trying to make it a better place in whatever particular areas have their attention or appeal to them. And with a healthy one, there's a sense of being uplifted, of ennobled, given wings. And ones are always seeking to reconnect with this deep instinctual, things. And at their best, I would say ones invite others to come meet them here, to share the sacredness, to share that feeling of nobility, that sense of alignment, where we see the holiness, the goodness of everyone, which is the real meaning of namaste, which is that I bow to that divinity in you that is also inherent in me. That is the true ground of the one. When I'm aligned with the higher qualities, I am in touch with that divine perfection. When I'm not aligned, then life is just a misery, and I feel bad and corrupt and irredeemable, and I just spend my entire life trying to get back into the garden, trying to get back into the good graces of God, of my guardian angel, or whoever I think is, you know, judging me from on high. And ones also tend to be the truth bearers. There's an alignment with truth. I think I said last week that they're compulsively honest, but they're the truth bearers versus falsification or bearing false witness. It's like the thrust of the soul is always to be in alignment with the truth. And in the higher levels, the ones have that real wisdom and discrimination of what is the right thing to do in every moment. So there's a very strong sense of integrity. That's a very important word. You'll hear words like integrity and principles. It's a sense of being rightly aligned with the universe.
Okay, Gail, I'm breaking all the rules because Gord hasn't done the Enneagram, and I'm sitting looking at Gord going, oh boy, that sounds like you. And then, no, that doesn't sound like you. Oh, yeah, that sounds like you. And oh, no, that doesn't sound like you. So I'm going insane here trying to type somebody else. Not a good move.
No, don't do that.
Don't do that. I mean, you know, there's some things there that, you know, I'm looking at Gord going, oh, maybe he's got a fair bit of the sensitive withdrawn type as well. You know, you're pretty withdrawn dude, and I'm looking down the list and loyalist.
ones aren't really withdrawn. They're what we call the dutiful or the compliant types, which means that they're trying to be responsible and do their duty and show up as, you know, good boys and girls, do what's right, do what God wants them to do. So as you can imagine, they often end up in the pulpit because ones like to teach and preach, and their editors and their judges, and trying to always come down on the side of what's right. In fixation, they tend to see things more in black and white. You know, this is right, this is wrong, the Bible says this, you know, you're going to hell, that kind of thing.
But, see, hold on, Gord was my counselor at camp, and I remember him saying that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But Gord, I'm also looking at six, the loyalist, committed, security-oriented, engaging, responsible, anxious, and suspicious.
Let's not bring another type in.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Okay, I'll shut up now. Okay, so back to number one, the reformer, the rational, idealistic type, principled, purposeful, self-controlled, and perfectionistic. Help me understand an unhealthy version of reformer.
So the unhealthy version of reformer is someone who becomes very intolerant and believes that only their very rigid and strict and narrow point of view is what should prevail, and that people are either saints or sinners, and that everyone who doesn't agree with me or what I believe or my religion or how I see the world is bad and either needs to be saved. So there's a strong missionary impulse.
Yeah, you've just described the evangelical church.
Okay. It's the opposite of seeing that everything is perfect and we're all in this together. It's like, no, I'm right and you're wrong. It's more specific than that. It's not, for the one, it's not really that I'm right. It's that what I believe is right, what I think is right, my belief system is right, and you ignore it at your peril. So when I'm unhealthy, you know, I'm proselytizing, I'm being a missionary, and even down, less healthy than that, I'm condemning people who don't believe or act the way I feel that they should.
Seriously, this is uncanny. The everything you've just said strikes me as, so look, let's look at the evangelical church just for a second. The thing that sets them apart is they are reformers. They want to reform the world. But then when they slip into a particular evangelical denomination or a particular evangelical church or a particular evangelical human person slips into that unhealthy mode, they become jerks. They become pushy, arrogant jerks.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's true down the levels of health in any of the type. Type one, the unhealthy manifestation of type one tends to be one that is particularly visible in our culture. It's often made fun of in movies. on SNL, that Dana Carvey character, the
church lady.
She is like a very, you know, fixated, neurotic type one, wagging her finger. Wagging your finger at somebody is a very, you know, fixated illustration of the type. It's like, you know, you're just not doing this right. If you would just listen to me, the world would be a better place, you know, but we're just going to hell in the handbasket because, you know, you won't wake up and you're doing the wrong thing. So there's a lot of judgment in the fixation of the one. There's, first of all, a lot of self-judgment. The type one, there's a lot of, there's a very strong thread of oneness in the church. Certainly the whole Puritan thing is a one-ish, a very one-ish expression of religion. But ones are very self-critical, very harsh on themselves. They're always lacerating themselves. Now, again, I'm not talking about a healthy one. I'm talking about more fixated down the levels of health. But they're always, you know, criticizing themselves. And one of the things that they'll say, again, if we go back to the childhood pattern, is that ones almost, you know, very consistently remember a childhood where they were very severely criticized and punished, and there was virtually no attention given to their goodness or their virtue or their good behavior. And ones internalize that, along with the internalization of having this black spot and, you know, something wrong with me. And so they can be very punitive to themselves. Now, you can only do that so much, you know, be whipping yourself so much before you need some release of that pressure. And so you start criticizing other people and you start whipping other people. So a lot of, judgment, you know. Ones always have opinions about things, even things they don't know anything about.
Guard. No, I'm just saying, I am not helping this conversation at all. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, they just tend to have just very, you know, clear opinions about things. Now, in the healthy levels, they make just the wisest, you know, discriminating, you know, people that you really want to talk to because they have that tolerance.
But guard. Man. Okay. All right. Listen. People have just been listening. They're interested. What do they do?
Well, start to read about the Enneagram and see if you can discover your type. And that's really the portal. That's the entryway. When you start learning about who you are, and I often liken it as getting to see like an X-ray of your own personality. That's very specific. It's very deep. And one of the things that I love that Richard Rohr always says is, until you are completely humiliated, you have not found your own type. So there is something when you do discover your type and you start reading about all of this. I mean, it's a mixed bag. It's like, oh, hallelujah, right? This is my potential. This is my essence. I can go for this. But you also are faced with, oh, my gosh, these are my defense mechanisms. This is how I show up as a pain in the butt all the time. This is why my friends and loved ones are, you know, always angry at me. These are the potholes that I'm falling into all the time. But the wonderful thing about that is it explains exactly why. It goes back to the root causes of when we, you know, experience that division, that separation from our divinity, and our ego takes over and starts trying to create this ersatz version of what we really long for. That's how we get into trouble. So it's a very compassionate system, I think. There are some rocky pieces where you have the opportunity to really look in the mirror and see all the craziness in your personality. And the important thing there is to understand, and the Enneagram makes this very clear, is that you are not your personality. The Enneagram does not show us who we are. It shows us who we take ourselves to be, because we have created these personality patterns that we're so ensnared in. It's the trance of personality. But you work through that. When you become familiar with that trance of personality, what opens up then is what your actual essence, what your true state of being is. And then we can embrace that.
So well said. So well said. Gail Scott, Enneagram. She is an Enneagram master. She is an unbelievably talented human being when it comes to discernment, when it comes to, you know, looking through people's ego agendas and getting to the heart of things. And Gail, you have done many, many things in your life. I'm looking at your bio, which is posted on our website here. Mm-hmm. Tell me about your clientele that maybe includes many well-known actors, opera singers, writers, and directors?
I grew up in Los Angeles, and I was in the Hollywood film production community for many, many, many years. Also in Vancouver for many years. I was actually in on the ground floor of the Vancouver film industry in the early 70s, it was. As I was working with actors and writers and screenwriters and studying the Enneagram, I realized that the Enneagram would be an amazing tool for character development, which is what particularly what actors care about. You know, what is my motivation? Why would I do this? Well, the Enneagram will tell you that exactly. So I started teaching workshops in Hollywood about the nine types of characters. And one of the things you'll notice is that movies that we tend to really like tend to be true to Enneagram type. In fact, typecasting actually means Enneagram typecasting. If you're a three, you always play threes. Nobody in Hollywood knew about the Enneagram when I started teaching it, but it sort of spread like wildfire because it's such a powerful tool. So what happened was that friends, actors, also directors and writers would send me a script and say, I'm supposed to play this part of, you know, Freddie, you know, what type do you think he was? So yeah. I would do an analysis. And then once you're actually playing a real psychology, you know, character, it's a much better performance because there's coherence, it all makes sense. So I did that for a lot of years. I still do it, not as much since I moved to Colorado, but it's an amazing tool for that.
Well, without revealing too much, you have helped me tremendously in my life. So I'm just going to hit it and quit right there. Thank you, Gail. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. Gail is a friend. I have a friend, Gord.
Yeah, a friend in Boulder.
Yeah. Gail, thank you so much. Sorry, yes?
Yeah. Unfortunately, I'm in the midst of creating and mounting my new website, so I can't give you a website address to go to.
That's okay.
So
that's
the right. Only way to get for your peeps to get in touch with me is to write to me directly. One of the things I do is I help people discover their type. I do just counseling and all kinds of Enneagram therapy, yeah. But also just helping people discover their type because there's nothing that this system can do for you, really, if you're mistyped or until you have found your real type.
It's kind of important. Okay, Gail, next week when we talk to you again at 3 Eastern, we'll chat about the helper, the achiever, and the individualist.
And which one are you?
Oh, I don't know. Let's see. Individualist.
That's right.
Sensitive, withdrawn. Now, again, it seems like there's an anomaly here because sensitive, I don't know, I get that, but withdrawn, like, withdrawn? I mean, I am withdrawn. Wait, hold on. Yeah. We're not talking about me now. Moving on. Moving on. Gail, thank you for your time.
Okay.
All
you're
right.
So welcome.
Bye, Gail.
Bye. See you next week.
Yeah, bye. Oh, she's fun. Did you learn anything, Gord?
Yes.
Do you think there's a possibility it might be a, what was the one there? The reformer?
No. I'm relating to the peacemaker. Far more than the reformer.
You are, huh?
Absolutely. But I'm probably in the intellectual section, the other one's the 4, 5, 6.
Well, that's what I was thinking, because Peacemaker is the body type, and the 5, 6, 7 is the head type,
I'm
and you're a pretty head dude.
Yeah.
You're a head
guy. Very large head.
Yeah.